It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, sleep.
Well, I'm a-waiting for your daddy.
That's what my baby said.
But honey, I got a passion
for my king-size bed.
Cause I gotta go to bed, cause I'm tired of sleeping. I can't go to sleep, cause I'm tired of sleeping.
So
if students could go in later and stay later, that might fix a lot of the problems that adolescents have with sleep.
I couldn't sleep at all last night.
Those most sleep deprived are those on the night shift.
It's gonna be a long night. It's gonna be all right on the night shift.
I do think that's a funny thing, that sleep is sort of the last bastion where you have total privacy from advertisers.
To get a good night's sleep, try two-layer Ambien CR. The first layer dissolves quickly to help you fall asleep. And unlike other sleep aids, a second dissolves slowly to help you stay asleep.
Let's hit the hay.
Hit the hay.
I've been working all day. Hit the hay.
Hit the hay.
I earn my pay. Hit the hay.
Hit the hay.
All right. It's time for a nap that will leave you rested and ready to go.
Is sleep keeping you awake at night? Probably at least some of the time. According to the NIH, 30% of Americans have trouble sleeping. 60 million of us filled prescriptions for sleep medications in 2011. That's up from 46 million in 2006. Today, we're looking at something we all need, but a lot of us have trouble getting enough sleep. MacArthur genius Karen Russell dreams up a world in which you can donate sleep, but first, producer Doug Gordon catches up with Kat Duff. She's the author of The Secret Life of Sleep.
Kat, what inspired you to write The Secret Life of Sleep?
I have always loved to sleep. It's always been a favorite thing of mine. And such a mystery. It's such a mysterious thing. What happens during all those hours that we can't remember? And as a writer, I like to explore those common everyday experiences that we tend to overlook or forget or pay no attention to. My first book was about illness, and when I sat down to start another writing project, the subject of sleep jumped on the page, and I thought, oh boy, this will be fun.
It sure is fun to read. As you mentioned, Kat, you've always liked to sleep, even when you were a young girl, and I may be in the minority here, but when I was a young boy, I didn't really enjoy sleeping at all. What was it that you liked about sleeping when you were young?
I loved the chance to let everything and everybody go. And go in my own room. You know, we tend to romanticize childhood as a carefree time, but there's a lot of pressure to live up to everybody's expectations, and I loved being able to shut the door on that and go into my own room, be unsupervised and by myself, and have my own private experiences.
You write that our waking selves are like lily pads floating on the surface of our night selves. That's a really beautiful phrase. Can you elaborate on what you mean by that?
Yes, there's various levels of that. Very literally, our sleep lives support our day lives. There's so much that goes on when we sleep. We regenerate tissues, we build bones, we make memories, we strengthen our immunity, we sort through our emotional issues. So much goes on. We would not be anything in the daytime if we didn't have our sleep. So literally, sleep supports our day lives. But on another level, I've always had the sense that sleep is a bigger world than the one I inhabit by day. I think that cognitive psychologists are really beginning to confirm that notion as they begin to define the breadth and depth of our unconscious processing that goes on all the time. We'll notice it every now and then. For example, if you're trying to tell a friend about a movie and you can't remember the name of the movie, and an hour later when you're doing something totally different, it pops in your head. Well, during that hour, all that unconscious processing was going on and accessing information that you couldn't access in the moment by day. There's just such a large field of experience and knowledge that we get to tap into in our sleep.
Kind of a yin-yang thing almost, a way our sleeping life informs our waking life and vice versa?
Yes, I think that's a wonderful analogy.
As the title of your book, The Secret Life of Sleep, conveys, we don't know that much about sleep because it lies outside of our conscious awareness. And you've done a lot of research into the science of sleep. How much do we really know about it?
Well, I'm sure we're we're still scratching the surface. The scientific inquiry of sleep is actually fairly recent, just started up in the middle of the 20th century with the development of things like the electroencephalogram and other brain imaging techniques that have allowed us to find out that there's a lot of activity going on inside of us when we sleep. But when you get outside of that Western scientific tradition, there are traditions throughout the world that have thousands of years of observation about sleep. And one of the interesting things to me that I discovered in the research here is that ancient Hindu and Buddhist texts from BC times identified stages of sleep that are now being confirmed by neuroscientists here in the 21st century.
We're told that the ideal amount of sleep to get is 8 hours every night. Is this true?
Well, it is a normative average, but I'm sure most sleep scientists and sleep doctors would give you a range of something like 7 to 9 hours. It is a very individual thing. Some people don't do well unless they have 9 or 10 hours, and others can do well on 4 or 5. But that's the normative average.
Yeah, I think people like Martha Stewart and Bill Clinton have said that they get by on 4 hours of sleep. Do you think that's possible? Because that's half the recommended daily allowance. Do you think it's really possible to get by on that little sleep?
Well, as Bill Clinton has acknowledged, I think he literally said when he was asked if he would give any advice to the incoming President Obama, and he said, get enough sleep. He said, all the mistakes I've made in my political career were from trying too hard and not getting enough sleep. One of the tricky things about if you actually do need more sleep, but you're only getting 4 or 5, one of the first abilities that we lose with sleep deprivation is that capacity to observe ourselves and look at our behaviors. So someone may think they're doing just fine in 4 or 5 hours, but if you talk to their family, they'll say they're irritable and impatient. You talk to their coworkers, and they say they have to go over their work because there's so many mistakes. So we aren't always the best judge.
I want to talk about dreaming. There's one thing that I'm especially curious about. Are we conscious when we dream?
It's so interesting to think about that, isn't it? That was one of the surprising things as I started to read neuroscientists talking about sleep. Not all neuroscientists, but a good body of neuroscientists say, yes, we are conscious. Rudolfo Linus says that dreaming actually is consciousness itself in the absence of sensory input. And I think the key question is, what are we conscious of? When we're dreaming, we're very conscious of the imaginary world we've created for ourselves, we might say, that we call dreams. We aren't as conscious of what is going on in our environments.
You mentioned, I think, in your book that even ancient philosophers said that we're conscious when we dream.
Yeah, and even in the West. Yeah, you can go back to Aristotle and some of the others, yes.
Wow, so it's kind of like if those guys and the other people we were talking about, ancient civilizations, if they were still around, maybe they'd be further ahead in sleep research, just how prophetic they are. What do you think is the biggest sleep-related question that neuroscientists and sleep researchers are still trying to answer?
Well, I believe what they would say is why we sleep, because I've often heard that and read that from neuroscientists who study sleep. It seems an odd question to me, or an odd thing to think that we haven't answered that question, because we've identified so many things that happen in sleep that really couldn't happen when we're awake. But I think that the hesitancy to say that's the reason is because it's still hard for us to accept that we are basically earthly creatures. We are born on this planet that rotates and has alternating phases of light and darkness, and we are created in that milieu, and every plant and animal, every cell of our bodies, every single-celled organism has an inbuilt circadian cycle of phases of activity, phases of rest, and I think sleep is just a function of that. And it's hard for us to really believe that we're that earthly.
Throughout your book, you write about some of the dreams that you've had, and there's one in particular that I'd like to ask you about. I think you had this dream a few years ago. It was about a drive you took down a winding canyon road. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
I do.
Can you tell me about that one?
Yeah. The dream was that I was trying to go to Ojo Caliente, which is about an hour and a half away from home. And in the dream, I was taking this dirt road that goes there, and it has to go down into the Rio Grande Gorge, and so it winds along the side of a very steep gorge, little narrow dirt road, and then crosses the river and then goes back up the side of the other. And in the dream, I was driving a little too fast, which I am prone to do, and I came around a blind corner, and a car was right in front of me coming the other way, and I veered to miss the car, and I went over the edge of the canyon.
And then something happened the next day, because didn't you have to actually drive that canyon road?
I did. I was going to an appointment in Ojo Caliente, and it's very unusual for me to dream about something that I'm getting ready to do the next day. So when I had that dream, I thought, gosh, it scared me a little bit, and I contemplated going way out of my way to go a different way and not have to go down into the canyon, but I love that canyon. So I decided, oh, heck, I'll just leave a little earlier and take my time. And then, of course, you know, I was going along, and I'd totally forgotten about the dream. And I was heading down into the canyon, and I had all the windows open. It was a beautiful day. I had my favorite CD on. I was singing along, and I had totally forgotten about the dream. And a bee flew into my car. Now, at the time, I thought I was allergic to bees. I'd had a couple of big reactions to bee stings, so I was frightened, and I turned to look to see where the bee was. And when I looked back, there was a car coming the other way right towards me, and I veered a little bit to get out of the way, but we kind of skidded parallel to each other and around each other. I did not go over the edge.
Wow.
But I was really glad that I was not going as fast as I am prone to do.
Do you think you were not going as fast because of the dream?
I know that I had decided to leave earlier. That was my kind of response to getting that dream, because it was so unusual. Usually I dream about, oh, all sorts of other things or crazy things where I'm back in high school or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so this felt a little bit like a warning.
Yeah. Near the end of your book, you say that our sleep is being sold back to us. Can you explain what you mean?
Yes. You know, as I did the research and was writing the book, I came to realize that sleep is really a natural resource. It's like the air we breathe, the water we drink. And in fact, we need it as much as we need the air we breathe and the water we drink. In fact, without sleep, we would die sooner than we would without air or water.
That's a very powerful, poetic way of looking at it. You pose an interesting question at the end of your book that I'd like to ask you now. What does sleep look like from sleep's perspective?
I wish I could ask that of my sleep itself and have an answer. What I imagine it might look like is that sleep repairs the damage that we do by day.
How has writing The Secret Life of Sleep changed the way you think about sleep?
You know, I've come to think of sleep as my best friend and helper. I've always enjoyed sleeping, but I've never really realized how much it helps me and how much I can turn to it. I can turn to it to help me remember things. I can turn to it to help me solve problems, even little things. If I can't think of a birthday present for someone, I just go to sleep on it. You know? And if I'm really upset about something, I tell myself, okay, don't stay up going over and over the same old line of thought you've had. Let it go, give it to your sleep, and see what comes out the next day. It's such a great ally and friend.
Kat Duff is the author of The Secret Life of Sleep. She spoke with Doug Gordon. So here's something to think about the next time you reach for the Ambien. Those 7 to 9 hours of uninterrupted sleep that we all long for may be a relatively recent phenomenon. It turns out that before the industrial age, most Europeans had 2 periods of sleep each night, with an hour or two awake in between. They thought that was normal. So what happened? Matthew Wolf Meyer writes about the development of modern sleep in a book called The Slumbering Masses. He's an anthropologist at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and that's where Steve Paulson reached him.
Matthew, you say sleep for Americans changed significantly in the decade, starting around 1996. What happened then?
The big thing that happens is direct-to-consumer marketing with pharmaceuticals. And so first, we see that with pharmaceuticals associated with depression, and then very quickly, because that's quite successful, other pharmaceuticals get swept up in the same project. And so one of the things that happens around the same time is a new way to affect sleep through pharmaceuticals.
So this was especially for people who had insomnia. Suddenly they had a pill they could take to help them out.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it was a different kind of chemical compound than what had been used previously. So in the 1980s, people were still using drugs that had been used for 50 years. And they were largely seen as being addictive and kind of dangerous in some respects because of the addictive quality. So what happened in the 90s was, I don't want to get too technical about it, but basically there is a new chemical compound that was able to be distilled, and it led to a set of drugs that are referred to as the Z drugs, and the Z is just because of sleep. And those are drugs like Ambien and Lunesta and Sonata. So the big difference, you might guess already, is that they weren't addictive. So you could take them for a week, you could stop taking them. There were no adverse effects to not taking the drug anymore.
Hmm. Now, you are actually a professor of anthropology. So what happens when you look at sleep through the lens of anthropology?
A couple things. First of all, our kind of assumption about what's referred to as the 11 to 7 model of sleep, that you go to bed around 11 o'clock, you wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning, is a fairly local one. And it's kind of a no-brainer, but we need to be reminded about it, that if you look in many parts of the world, that that's not the normative model. So siesta cultures in Southern Europe and Latin America and China, Taiwan, all sorts of other places where it's not one continuous jag of sleep at night. And it's definitely not from 11 until 7 o'clock in the morning. And so you start to realize that napping is a pretty normative way for a lot of people to sleep around the world. And the other thing, because I'm not just an anthropologist, but also a historian, is looking at how sleep has changed over time. So the way that we sleep these days in the United States is a relatively recent invention, that it's about 150 years old, and that previous to that, people were sleeping quite differently.
You spent a lot of time doing research at the Midwest Sleep Disorders Clinic and other sleep clinics. What were some of the surprising things you found during your research?
The thing that was the biggest surprise for me, and probably for most of the social scientists that I talk to, is that a lot of the doctors aren't strictly interested in medicalizing patients. So the kind of a naive assumption is that doctors, however benevolent they are, also just want to give you a drug and fix the problem that way. And what I really learned from the doctors that I worked with was that if they could figure out a social fix, that was their preference. So for instance, there's something called delayed sleep phase. It makes people owls. People want to wake up later. So one of the problems that people with delayed sleep phase have is that they have a hard time getting to work or school at a set time. And so teenagers who have delayed sleep phase often end up in real trouble with school because they need to be there at 7:30, but they can't wake up until 9:30 or 10 o'clock. And so the doctors that I know did a lot of advocacy work on the part of students who had conditions like that, where they would talk to school administrators and say, we could put this kid on a drug, but what we would rather do is have him come into school late.
This is fascinating. I mean, it's sort of the suggestion is maybe high school should start at 11 in the morning and, you know, go till 7 in the evening or something like that.
Right. I mean, that's one of the possibilities, that if we had more flexible institutions, that we wouldn't necessarily need to medicalize sleep as much as we do. So if students could go in later and stay later, that might fix a lot of the problems that adolescents have with sleep. But there's problems. One of them is that school is really seen as kind of childcare, although we don't necessarily think about it this way. While you go to work, your kids are at school. And if they're going to school at a different time than you're working, then who's watching those kids between 8 o'clock and 10 o'clock in the morning,
right? You have to change the work schedule to accommodate the sleep of teenagers.
Right.
So getting back to sleep clinics, do they work? I mean, are they effective in helping people who have trouble sleeping?
Yes. If there's some equivocation in my voice, it kind of depends on the problem. There's some conditions that are fairly straightforward in their treatment. Things like sleep apnea can be treated pretty successfully with things like CPAP and BiPAP machines, as long as patients can kind of tolerate the technology and are persistent with the treatment. A lot of insomnia comes in two different forms. There's the primary insomnia where people have a hard time going to sleep at night. And you can take a drug. And generally speaking, those drugs lose their physiological effectiveness, but not necessarily their psychological effectiveness fairly quickly. So a lot of times people keep taking a drug, even though it doesn't actually have a physiological effect on them, because they feel like they need to take the drug in order to get to sleep. And so in a sense, it's still effective, but maybe not. But the maybe more troubling kind of insomnia is the insomnia where you wake up in the middle of the night and you have a hard time going back to sleep.
Right. And I've had plenty of that myself, but I tend to go through phases. And what happens, you know, this has happened a few nights in a row, is you wake up and you think, uh-oh, I'm not going to be able to get back to sleep. It becomes a psychological thing.
Right. So the radical thing that I'm going to tell you is to believe in human evolution, and that if you do, then waking up in the middle of the night is not a form of insomnia. It's actually the kind of sleep that we've evolved to prefer. So if you look at historical records before the 1840s, people are sleeping that way, and that's the norm. And one of the strange things that we see now is that when people are sleeping like that and they go seek out medical treatment and get a drug, they end up developing secondary sleep disorders. So they're taking a drug that keeps them asleep, but their body still wants to wake up in the middle of the night. And so they start sleepwalking in the middle of the night because technically their brain is still asleep, but part of their brain wants to be awake. And so the best thing to do generally is to not take a drug when you're waking up in the middle of the night, but also to realize that it's not necessarily a physiological problem. It might be a social problem in that it's difficult to work the next day, but then maybe a nap is better than taking a drug.
This is a fascinating take on insomnia. I mean, you're really suggesting that there's no intrinsic problem with insomnia, except that if you've got to get to work or school the next morning. But I mean, this is kind of just all part of the way the body naturally wants to respond. I mean, to wake up at odd times and then you're going to go back to sleep.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the reason why many of the sleep disorders that are associated with late sleeping or early rising are treated as problems is because of the social problems they produce. Not because there's something fundamentally wrong with your body. It's something fundamentally wrong with the expectations that people have of us to be alert and productive at specific times of the day. So if we get rid of that kind of artifice about when we should be active and productive, and instead abide by when we need to sleep and when we want to sleep, a lot of that medicalization of sleep suddenly disappears.
Matthew Wolfmeyer is the author of The Slumbering Masses: Sleep, Medicine, and Modern American Life. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Coming up, novelist Karen Russell imagines a world in which healthy dreamers can donate their sleep to insomniacs. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Today, we're talking about an elusive and increasingly expensive commodity, a good night's sleep. Writer Karen Russell has been imagining a world in which people are actually dying from insomnia, and the only remedy is a kind of creepy technology called sleep donation. You might remember Karen Russell as the MacArthur genius who wrote Swamplandia and Vampires in the Lemon Grove. Here's how her new story begins.
The pundits promise, with weird relish, that we are seeing the end of sleep as we know it. TV has become a glum hall of prophets. Dr. Davisha Frank from the Boston Sleep Tank, who speaks like a robot programmed to self-destruct. Dour professors wearing sunflower yellow ties that film well. According to these professional Cassandras, sleep has been chased off the globe by our 24-hour news cycle, our polluted skies and crops and waterways, the bald eyeballs of our glowing devices. We Americans are sitting in an electric chair that we engineered. What becomes of our circadian rhythms, the old, glad harmonies that leapt through us like the vascular thrust of water through leaves of grass? Bummer news, Walt. That song's done. And the endogenous clock, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, hereditary prize of every human, that tiny star cluster of neurons in the hypothalamus, which regulates our yawning appetites for hard winter light and spacey blackness, the master clock that syncs us to one another and to the Earth's rotation, the sun and the moon, to all the sister kingdoms on the 24-hour circuit, bacteria, Gila monsters, great sequoias, blue whales, orange groves, bear cubs, mustangs, toadstools, leopards, golden ingles, hyacinths, hippopotami, those tiny wizards, the butterflies, those glue artists, the arachnids, and all the sequin life on the seafloor, the black urchins that improbably still clock time with us. Bummer news, everybody. The clock stops for humanity. Time itself will soon become an anachronism. Time, as our species has lived it on the planet, will cease to exist. No more dark-light binary. No more active red daytime, blue evening dissolving. No longer is sunshine the coagulant of consciousness, causing us to clot into personalities, to cohere once more on our pillows each morning. These TV scientists predict a global desertification of dreams. Soon, they promise, the disruption will afflict all of us. Sleep will go extinct. And eventually, unless we can find some way to synthesize it, so will we.
Wow.
It's kind of grim. Sorry, guys.
Well, so let's talk about this world you've created in Sleep Donation. This is set in the near future in the midst of a lethal insomnia epidemic. What's going on as you imagine it?
We're 7 years into this insomnia epidemic, and they've invented a new technology, pretty recent technology, sleep donation. I think the closest analogy I have to something in our America, not this imaginary one, would be sort of the American Red Cross, you know, or blood donation. So if you sign up for this program, a white van comes to your house at night and they slip a catch mask, the silver helmet on you, and you breathe into a tube, you take an ultra-sedative, you're rolled under into sleep, and you donate your dreams to an insomniac. And that's sort of the umbilicus that's attaching all of these insomniacs to life. I mean, they can no longer sleep on their own, so they're wholly dependent on these sleep donors.
So what's happened that there's this insomnia epidemic? I mean, have you worked out a kind of plausible medical scenario for this?
I hope so. I think that some of the underpinnings for it actually are plausible. I have some good neuroscientist friends, and we sort of had fun, dark fun, you know, drafting out a kind of orexin dysfunction, a dysfunction to the system that regulates arousal and sleep-wake cycle, appetite. And narcoleptics, they have just the opposite problem, right, where they have just a totally interrupted
wake cycle.
Exactly, wake cycle. Thanks, Anne. And in this world, I was thinking the dysfunction, no one knows what triggered it, if the cue is environmental, you know, if it has something to do, as in the section I just read, you know, there are all kinds of paranoid speculation that we've absolutely altered some animal rhythm with the way that we're living today, that it's connected to our glowing devices or maybe to some kind of underlying genetic cause that's been active. No one knows, right, what the trigger is. Except that it does seem like this growing population is suffering this orexin dysfunction and they can't sleep, and if they can't sleep, they die.
Wow. All of which brings us to your protagonist, Trish Edgewater. Her sister was one of the first to die in the insomnia epidemic, and So Trish now works for this emergency organization, kind of like the Red Cross, called the Slumber Corps. What can you tell us about Trish?
You know, things really didn't take off for me until that lady showed up. She's the first, I think, in my short story collection, there's an adult female protagonist, but I've never tried anything this length, and I was excited to have a first-person narrator who is this young adult woman. I sort of gravitate towards wall-eyed 13-year-old boys or monsters, so this was exciting for me. And she's in her late 20s, and she lost her sister to this fatal insomnia. You know, her sister had had trouble sleeping her whole life, and then for unclear reasons, when she was in her 20s as a college student, this dysfunction kicked in and eventually killed her. They didn't have the sleep donation technology at that time. So I was imagining someone who's in some ways quite naive, right? She really wants to give her life unreservedly to a cause, and this seems to be the right one, where she's going to solicit sleep donors for this program. You know, they have all these insomniacs on their weight rolls, and they need healthy sleepers. They need good dreamers to provide rest for these people. What she does is she has this sort of dark talent, I guess, for grotesquely kind of recreating her sister's death and implanting this nightmare in some ways in these potential donors. So her recruitment strategy, I was thinking, is pretty, speaking of ghoulish, would be pretty ghoulish. She feels increasingly ambivalent about the way she's going about asking for these sleep donations as the novella progresses.
There's a particular donor or donor family that Trish works with, Mr. and Mrs. Harkonnen, and their daughter, Baby A, and she's something kind of special. She's a universal donor?
Yeah, she's a universal donor. You know, it's funny, when I was first sort of sketching out this place, that was a throwaway detail that my unconscious just threw out like a frisbee. I don't know, that babies would be donors in this kind of a scenario, that the Supreme Court would rule that babies can be donors. And I was just thinking, you know, with some kind of Swiftian relish or something, that that is likely the best source of uncorrupted sleep.
It's such a creepy twist.
I was thinking, too, just the a sleeping baby is sort of emblematic of all kinds of innocence.
And this baby is only 6 months old, the first time someone takes her sleep. What's it called? Draining her or drawing it or something?
A draw and a catch, yeah, and the little sleep trundle. It does seem like in a crisis, the costs are always borne, right, by the weakest and the most vulnerable, that there is this way in an emergency situation where certain nuance looks at who is going to support the cost. All of that gets suspended, I guess. And I was thinking about that time of suspension, how dangerous it can be, where the need becomes so great that people stop asking certain questions. And I think that it just made sense to me that in this particular para-reality, it would be these babies that they were draining for sleep.
Well, one of the things I like, though, is that, yeah, you've set up this horrific thing, but in fact, they are having the moral debate there inside your story also. I mean, the father of Baby A isn't so sure he wants his baby donating sleep anymore.
The scale is a little gonzo, right, to have this set against a backdrop of a global insomnia epidemic. But those questions feel pretty close to the home that we're living in here. And I think what we owe one another, the context in which a gift like that is made, the troubling aspect of a gift like that, right? I was thinking the obvious analogs, I guess, would be blood and organ donation. But you have a gift that's really, they call it the gift of life for a reason, right? I mean, it's an inherently unequal position between donor and donee. Mm-hmm. And I think that can create all kinds of moral complexity. And I think for this father, part of the horror story there for me was that these are very good people, the Harkonnens, and they do feel an obligation, this moral obligation to donate sleep to help, you know, and with sort of this emergency situation. The father has sort of less and less confidence that this institution has any sense of him as a human man or his daughter as a human daughter any longer, right, as this flesh and blood daughter, that she's sort of become this larger-than-life baby, a universal donor. I should mention that they just discovered that her sleep is of a purity, that it can be transfused into any body. It's usually a difficult process to match a sleep donor to an insomniac, and not so with this little kid.
Our producer, Doug Gordon, was just showing me an article about a guy in the real world, not in a fictional world. There's a guy, an inventor named Hunter Lee Soik, who's created a new app called Shadow. And what he wants to do with it is create a huge dream database in order to discover connections between our sleeping and our waking selves.
And can I tell you something wild? So when we were working on this, I mean, it's just a little throwaway bit, and that's not, it's not throwaway, but I mean, it's not what it was in the original draft, which was that I had the CDC, you know, and these other new agencies were tracking dreams, right? They have dream epidemiologists because they want to see if there are these potentially infectious nightmares. They're doing dream donations and some nightmares are infectious. That's what they're filtering and, you know, screening the sleep for. So I had this idea that there would be like a CDC database, the same way they keep databases for other contagious diseases, and alerts and updates, sort of like the gazelle dream runs rampant in eastern Ohio, you know, or just they would be able to track the patterns of dreams the way you track weather patterns.
But I think that's what this guy really wants
that's
to do.
That's what he's doing. That's what I'm saying. Isn't that crazy, though? I mean, I just thought you can't even keep ahead of what's actually happening.
Art imitating life or life imitating art.
It's a funny thing. This woman who has such a real ambivalence by the end of the novella about the work that she's doing, sort of coercing people to make these donations. I do think that's a funny thing, that sleep is sort of the last bastion where you have a total privacy from advertisers. It'll be interesting to see who signs up for that app.
Well, I was going to say thanks for writing a book that'll keep us all awake at night. Karen, thanks so much.
Thank you, Anne.
Well, it's always fun talking with you.
I had a really great time. I'll send you guys some dreams if they ever invent this technology. I'll select the good ones.
Your dreams will be worth more than other people's. Writer Karen Russell. She was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for her novel Swamplandia, and she's received a MacArthur Genius Award. We were talking about her e-novella Sleep Donation. Now, in the new book, Karen mentions a documentary called Is Sleep Going Extinct? And that got us wondering what this fictional documentary would sound like. Chances are it would not sound anything like this.
The dodo. The saber-toothed tiger. The 8-track tape. Is sleep about to join them on the list of extinct species? Is it more likely that Godot will show up before Mr. Sandman does? Today, we answer the question, is sleep going extinct? Is capitalism kicking sleep out of bed and forcing it to wander the streets aimlessly? Jonathan Crary is the author of 24/7, Late Capitalism and the Ends of Sleep.
One of the ways in which I talk about sleep is as a figure or as an example of other possible barriers to the relentless financialization and monetization of social space.
Jessa Gamble.
We're living in a culture of jet lag, global travel, 24-hour business, shift work. Our modern ways of doing things have their advantages, but I believe we should understand the costs.
Is it true that even a man with one eye can see something bad's gonna happen to me? Me being a person who can't sleep? To find out, we asked one of Australia's leading sleep scientists, Dr. Craig Biddlecombe.
Yeah, I've only got the one eye, so I don't have proper depth perception. I've tried 3D glasses, doesn't really work. But I can tell you, if you can't sleep, something bad is going to happen to you. There's a direct cause and effect relationship. It's like that DirecTV commercial. When you can't sleep, you become irritable. When you become irritable, your girlfriend leaves you. When your girlfriend leaves you, you spend more time at Starbucks flirting with that cute barista named Lola. And when you flirt with that cute barista named Lola, her jealous homicidal ex-boyfriend, Rocket, is going to kill you. So, yeah, even a man with one eye can see that something bad's going to happen to you if you can't sleep.
That's it for our conversation about sleep. But how have you been sleeping? And what do you think about the commodification of sleep? You can join the conversation on our Facebook page. Coming up, the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide has been on our minds this week, and we'll have a story from Rwanda about love, hope, and a restaurant called Heaven. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
Monster, the Roller Coaster.
By BJ Novak.
The almost legendary artist Christo was on the verge of completing a dream that he had held close through his entire career. To design an American roller coaster inspired by nothing less profound than life itself. Life, the ultimate roller coaster. Today was an important one for Christo. It was the day that he and his financiers would observe the reactions of the most consequential people who would ever ride the ride. The 12 persons selected at random for a small focus group. "All right, everyone," said Tom, the focus group leader. "What did people think?" "I didn't like all the ups and downs," said one. "I wanted more ups and downs," said two. "Why did the family part at the beginning end so abruptly?" asked three. "I hated the family part," said 10. "Also, why were there two of them?" asked 4. "There was that track that took you out of the family at the beginning and it was so exciting and sudden, but it lasted like 2 seconds and led you right to another part that ended up almost exactly the same as the first one." "It wasn't exactly the same," clarified 5, "but yeah, it had a lot of the same dynamics." "Did people like certain parts of the ride more than others?" "I thought the first half was more fun, but the second half was more interesting," said 9. "Yeah," said 12. "Somehow in the second half, it felt like I was actually driving the car I was in, even though, of course, we were just along for the ride, same as always." "What should we call this roller coaster?" asked Tom. "Life," said 2. Everyone got quiet. "Yeah, life," said 8. Christo, watching behind the glass, nodded. "Monster," said 5. "Monster?" asked the focus group leader. "Yeah, monster. Monster sounds cool," said 4. "No," thought Christo. "Let's take a vote," said the focus group leader. "Monster it is." Christo was angry almost beyond the borders of the much-surveyed powers of his own comprehension. Monster? He did not spend the last 19 years of his career dreaming that one day he might be remembered primarily as the designer of an amusement park roller coaster ride called Monster. But his dream was dead now, murdered by idiot whims, and there was nothing he could do about it anymore. Oh well, thought Christo, that's life.
BJ Novak, with A Dangerous Idea from his debut collection, One More Thing, Stories and Other Stories. You'll find more Dangerous Ideas on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. The 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide has been on everyone's mind recently. But rather than looking back, let's look forward. Rwanda today is a very different country than it was 20 years ago. Josh Ruxin has been on the ground for much of that recovery. He moved to Rwanda with his wife Alyssa about a decade after the genocide to do aid work. And they wound up opening a restaurant called Heaven. Now he's written a book about their experience and about the untold story of Rwanda's comeback.
Actually, after the genocide, the sweet and incredible secret was that Rwanda really got on its feet, went through an incredible reconciliation process, and started to experience tremendous economic growth. Just in the past decade, it's been growing probably 2.5-3 times as quickly as the U.S., just to put it in perspective.
At the same time, there still is evidence of the genocides all over the place. I mean, you tell a story in the book about it was just after you and Alyssa arrived at your new home. There was a morning when 3 Rwandan women came to your house. Actually, can you tell that story?
Yeah, we had just moved into this beautiful new house. And one morning we woke up and there was a knock at the door. And a few women said that they wanted to sit down and speak with us. And one of the women introduced herself as a survivor of the genocide whose brother had been murdered in the neighborhood, and she knew for a fact that he was buried in our backyard. And she was coming to ask us permission to dig up his bones and provide him with a proper burial.
How did you and Alyssa react when you found out?
We were, of course, shocked by it, but not overly shocked. Back 10 years ago, when there were strong rains, you would still see bones and bodies, or the remnants of bodies, that would be uncovered in the street. So that wasn't the most shocking bit of it. What really surprised us was that when she came back a few weeks later, they were all happy. In fact, they invited our daughter, who was just a baby then, Maya, out in the yard as they were exhuming and cleaning these bones, because it was a celebration for them. They felt lucky to have known where this family member was buried, unlike so many others, and they were able to lay him into a grave where they could revisit him. So it
I just find that astonishing. How do people arrive at that level of forgiveness, and how are they able to move past the anger?
Living in Rwanda all these years, it's something that we still don't understand. We have friends who miraculously have absolutely forgiven those who killed their family members. And the way they describe it to us, and it's a very similar experience across our friends, is that the hatred weighed so heavily on their hearts that they felt freed when they were able to meet the killers of their parents, of their siblings, and forgive them.
Has that happened in a lot of cases?
It has. It has. It has happened across entire communities in Rwanda. And actually, there actually is a reconciliation village where it's possible to go visit and hear directly from the perpetrators and from the victims' families how they are rebuilding their community and reestablishing kindness and a sense of progress among each other. It's just, there's nothing like it. And I personally don't understand it. I mean, I don't know how they have gotten to that point.
Hmm. You wound up talking shortly after those women came to your house. You know, and this is your new house. Nobody really wants to move in and suddenly discover that people were killed in your house. And you went next door to a neighbor who then kind of, he made the story even bigger. Describe a little bit his memories of what it was like during those days in Rwanda.
Well, Pierre Antonio, who's our next door neighbor to this day, he was a business person going back generations in the region. He and his family were holed up next door to our home during the genocide. And when there was a break, he actually managed to shuttle his kids and his wife out of the country. And he was concerned not only about his employees who he hadn't been able to save, but also about an orphanage that he was aware of. And loaded up with cash, he went back into Rwanda at the height of the genocide and saved so many lives. And he literally paid for them. And here's a man who's just incredibly modest and does not go out of his way to tell these stories. And he's a Schindler.
Hmm. He said he'd, in several cases, happened upon gangs who were in the process of killing someone, and he would basically ransom the person away.
He had different denominations of notes in his pockets based on how he sized up the gang of killers, because if he showed too much money, he feared for his own life, that they might try to take everything that he had. If he showed too little, then it would be insulting and he might not be able to save that person's life. So his experience was just incredible, and he is the hero who lives next door. And one of the toughest things that he told us about was that after this body was exhumed, and actually in the course of starting to write my book, A Thousand Hills to Heaven, I noticed that the door frames on all of our doors had been broken at one point and repaired. And I asked Pierre Antonio about it, and he said, yes, regretfully, there were several people who were murdered in your home, and that's why the doors were bashed in.
Because the killers hacked the doors up trying to get in?
yeah, they had broken down the doors, and there were people who were hiding in our house in the height of the genocide. And there were people who he had, I think, dozens of people stowed away in his home, but he certainly couldn't save everyone.
And then that sounds like that's the story for your entire neighborhood. I mean, it's not just your home. It's the house across the street and the one, you know, down the block and the one next door.
Yeah, it was a killing field. And it's unimaginable. I can't imagine it.
So tell me about the restaurant that you and your wife opened, the restaurant called Heaven. Aside from being beautiful, the restaurant also represents a new way of thinking about poverty, small scale rather than the great big massive aid programs. Am I right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that aid, of course, is important when it's well deployed with governments that actually spend it well and are not corrupt. And Rwanda actually has one of those very few relatively non-corrupt governments. But what then? I mean, what should aid actually be about? And increasingly, I see this incredible opportunity to invest in the private sector, to invest in small and medium-sized enterprises, to create the business engine that we are quite fond of here in the U.S. And I think we have this standard by which we think that somehow poorer countries should want for something different, but they don't. The dreams of these nations are the same, and the dreams of their citizens are the same. One of our dear friends on opening night of Heaven, going 7 years ago now, walked in and he grabbed Alyssa and hugged her and said, "Our country doesn't need aid anymore. What our country needs is 1,000 heavens." So just 1,000 small businesses like this, each generating dozens of jobs and hundreds of downstream jobs, that'll put the aid cronies out of business. That's what we need.
Josh Ruxin is the author of 1,000 Hills to Heaven, Love, Hope, and a Restaurant in Rwanda. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. Doug Gordon produced today's show with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, Stephanie Youngblood, and Raymond Tungakar. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks to you for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.